Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 119 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, as always, great to see you again.
Good to see you, Jason.
So this week, I figured let's start talking a little bit about what's going on with Congress. I know we're in election year, so I feel like there's a lot of stuff that people are trying to do or not do before this election happens. And it looks like the House has actually been really busy with looking at a lot of crypto stuff. The big one that apparently is going to be getting a vote next month is what they're calling FIT 21, which is Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act. And I guess it's exciting. I mean, it theoretically could be on the path to be the first bit of cryptocurrency legislation that has passed through the first level of Congress in quite some time. So we'll see what happens. I don't think there's a lot of expectation that anything is going to get passed this year with it being an election year, but it theoretically is kind of setting it up for some hopefully traction in early next year.
Yeah. I saw that one of the congressmen who were involved in the writing of the bill posted about it. And I was like, okay, I'll go back and kind of read through it. And I just never did because it's kind of miserable to read through legislative text. But it's good because, you know, we've talked about it ad nauseum for over a year where we don't have legislation. We just have the SEC shooting holes in the wall, and some of them get patched up and some of them stay holes, and there's just nobody knows what to do. And while Congress is reviewing and voting on this FIT 21 bill, they were also voting and rejecting the SEC ruling that basically they told banks that if they held Bitcoin or digital assets in custody, they had to be held as liabilities, and then they need to hold assets in order to offset those liabilities. So if someone had, if Wells Fargo said they were going to custody digital assets, they would hold somebody's $100 million in Bitcoin. Well, they had to hold $100 million in treasuries or cash in order to offset that. That's not typical. You know, they don't do that for all asset classes, right? That's just not how it works. Banks are notoriously not backed by anything. And so they went through this entire voting, like the House voted against it, basically saying what you're doing is beyond the scope of the SEC and it doesn't make sense. And so I think this was in response to BNY Mellon's investigation into if they were going to custody Bitcoin. This was maybe a year and a half ago. And so all these banks are trying to get themselves ahead of the game and get into the digital asset world and figure out how to be the traditional finance world, but start incorporating this new digital asset stuff that everyone has to be convinced is not going away at this point. It's years and years and years of constant, you know, waves bashing against the shore. It's like the waves aren't going to stop. And so the BNY Mellon wasn't happy with the SEC's decision. And so when the banks aren't happy, then the lobbyists let the politicians know that. And then the politicians start to actually do things. So in this terrible political financial world, it's actually starting to revolve a little bit. And I'm not convinced that it's all good, but between the FIT 21 bill, between them pushing back against the SEC for making it more difficult for banks to custody digital assets, you know, these are things that I like to see as far as going from the SEC just being the sheriff in the Wild West that sometimes shoots the guy and sometimes arrests the guy and sometimes turns his back, right? And now it's like, oh, we actually have some laws, some rules, some things for people to follow. And we can let this industry kind of do what it's going to do.
So what you're talking about is the Staff Accounting Bulletin 121 that was meant to be just a internal SEC document that wasn't going to be a law. And somehow people said, oh, let's just make this law. And yeah, the shit kind of hit the fan as soon as that happened. And now everybody's against it. And what's interesting is now the House has come out and said, hey, we're going to veto this or oppose it. But Biden came out and said, if this gets to his desk, he's going to veto this because he agrees with the SEC and pretty much Elizabeth Warren on what's going to happen here. So there's still a war going on with crypto. There will be a war that will continue to go on for, I think, a lot of years until this really gets mainstream, since we're still just scratching the surface. But there's definitely a long ways to go from this perspective.
I did see that. I guess it was a memo or something that Biden put out from his desk, right? It's not like Biden's aide or, you know, kind of down the chain or a press conference, but like straight up a written document that said that it'll veto and the SEC needs to be able to regulate, et cetera. And I'm like, put it on his desk, make the guy veto it. Like, let's get this thing going. It's May, elections in November, and let's see what really happens. I mean, if people are as serious about digital assets and Bitcoin, cryptocurrency as I am, and in June or July before an election, he's going to veto something that basically says, yeah, the SEC can overreach in this one area and we're okay with it. And even if banks want to try this, they're not allowed to treat digital assets. They have to treat them differently than anything else. Yeah. Give me that. Let's see. Let's go ahead and throw it out there. I mean, I don't really like talking the political red team, blue team stuff, but you've got Trump on the other side, who's getting more and more open to Bitcoin and more and more Bitcoin friendly. He had a rally. I don't know what these are anymore. Campaign stops. They asked him about digital assets and Bitcoin, and he said Biden has no idea what he's doing. He just wants to get off the stage. But he said that he's not a fan of forcing innovation out of the United States. Is he pandering for votes? At least partially, maybe mostly. Yeah. But that's pretty much what everybody's doing in this time of year on a campaign, on a election year. So, you know, he's accepting donations in Bitcoin and crypto. That's a step ahead of the blue team. It's nice that Bitcoin is becoming a topic that's going to get talked about. If they were to debate in a presidential debate, like we usually get every other 4 years, I think Bitcoin would actually be a question in a presidential debate this year. So that's progress. That's moving the Overton window. It's okay to talk about Bitcoin. It's part of the mainstream. It's not for libertarians and drug dealers on the internet, right? We're talking about BNY Mellon. We'll talk more about banks and wealth management companies later today. But keep talking about it. Keep forcing the issue. I hope Biden does veto that bill. I guess he has to now that he said he will. That would be pretty spineless to put something out that says I'm going to veto it if you send it to me and then not veto it. So, like, let's push the issue, man. Let's make it happen. I'm all for it.
Yeah, it was interesting to listen to Mark Cuban, and Mark Cuban's always been a kind of a big fan of crypto in general, but he pretty much came out and said this election, if Biden loses, it's going to be because of Gary Gensler and the SEC. And he said the only thing that Biden can probably do to change this is that he either has to pass some sort of regulation on crypto, which they've really yet to do, or he has to turn over all the regulation for crypto over to the CFTC, which I think neither one of those is going to happen by the time
long shots
November comes around. But it was kind of an interesting perspective, and I've read a couple of opinion pieces that say don't base your entire decision on crypto. And I, not that I'm basing my entire decision on crypto, but there, I mean, that's a big piece of it, right? So if this, I don't know if you saw the video I sent you of the guy advising Biden on economic policy and the whole MMT, and he has no idea how the economy works and was just kind of worthless in the interview that he did. And I'm like, man, this is scary that the Democrats are doing this to the monetary policy and they have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah. So this, the guy who advises Biden, and he's an economist, and the reporter asks, like, okay, well, why are we borrowing money? Why don't we just print it all? And the guy locked up, frozen, no idea. Exactly right. All right. That's exactly what you should do, because it doesn't make sense. what she didn't say was, if you can just print all this money and there's no penalties, why even tax anyone, right? Because it would be nice if somebody said, oh, we tax people to incentivize and punish behaviors that we like and don't like. That's what taxing's all about. It's not like we don't need the money. It's only half of our entire budget. We just like to be able to push people in the direction we want to push them into with sticks and carrots that look like dollar bills. And so I wish that they would have gone deeper down that rabbit hole. I hope that guy goes on a campaign or a PR trail and gets on in front of more cameras, because people need to start thinking about this stuff. And, you know, speaking about borrowing, Japan is still struggling with their issues. They're the number one holder of U.S. treasuries. Their currency keeps slipping. They keep figuring out ways to bolster their currency, finding U.S. dollars to buy yen to reduce their exchange rate problems. The U.S. and Japan opened some swap lines to help them out, because the U.S. just can't let Japan sell a bunch of treasuries in an environment where they can't sell the treasuries at auction as it is. So, yes, borrowing is a problem. Printing is a problem. Like, taxing is actually probably the way it ought to be. If you drop the other two out, then it would be, hey, we want to go to war with this country, or we want to fund this country that's going to war with a different country. And you would have to get agreement from the people to tax them in order to fund the war. We don't have to do that anymore. They can just make up the money. They can buy their own treasuries if they have to. So, no, I think that guy that advises Biden is probably just as educated as anybody else on that side of the economic understanding of MMT, where if you push them on it, there's just a bunch of air behind their arguments. You know, there's not bedrock. And that's why the Austrian school of economics makes more sense. It's more based on reality, and there's just not a lot of fluff, right? I think that's why you see so many engineering minds that have bought into crypto and Bitcoin, is because it makes more sense than modern monetary theory, where you kind of do a little bit of math and it ends up with, just trust us, it works out. It's not a problem. And that doesn't jive with people that have engineering degrees. You keep going down the rabbit hole until you figure out, oh, okay, here's the bedrock. Here's the first principles. Let's build back up, and now everything makes sense. So yeah, I think it's nice to see them actually not be able to explain the garbage that they never explain. I'm on board. I wish they would do more of that.
So I want to circle back real quick to the House. There was one other thing that I did see that is interesting. I guess the House being somewhat active, and this one probably isn't for the best reason, but the House Democrats are about to propose a bill that is going to be targeting the crypto mixers. And we've talked about some of the Tornado Cashes of the world and the Samurai wallets and all of that they want to eliminate, because it is theoretically hurting, or people are using that to launder money. And a couple of things that is kind of interesting to that I was reading about too. One, the Treasury Department's FinCEN, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, has pretty much come out and said that if these companies, which Tornado Cash did not ever take custody of any of this Bitcoin or crypto in general, if they don't take custody and it's all kind of done in software, then they can't be held liable, which is kind of interesting from that perspective, the Treasury Department saying that. And then the other thing that's kind of funny is, for those people that aren't aware, there is the Tor network, which allows you to remain kind of completely anonymous on the internet and share information. And the CIA has been probably one of the biggest proponents of promoting the Tor network, which is how they use this to keep everybody safe. So they're a big believer in being able to do things anonymously, and you have the U.S. government and the CIA pushing Tor, but they are against the crypto mixers, which is kind of funny too. So because if they do end up passing any languages that talk about what can or can't be done, it might actually kind of fall back and affect the whole Tor network too, which will be interesting to see what happens here in the courts.
Yeah, so this kind of touches on one of the items where I'm always looking for why Bitcoin's going to fail, right? It's easy to convince yourself that Bitcoin's good to go. There's tons of bullish things to think about, but the tornado caches where essentially Bitcoin goes in, it mixes with other Bitcoin, and then you get your Bitcoin back so that if because the Bitcoin network is traceable and you can look back, if there's an address that is a terrorism group or a human trafficking wallet, if Bitcoin travels through that address and 25 transactions later you find it in your wallet, you could have dirty Bitcoin, which could be identified by chain analysis or these other groups. And those tornado caches and similar mixers allow you to kind of jumble that up with other Bitcoin. You can't really tell. And so I feel like there's a risk there if the government's like, hey, if this is dirty Bitcoin, if it's been through these targeted addresses, then we're going to confiscate it or it's unusable or whatever. And so that's a risk that I see. Now, one of the good things is somebody had dirty Bitcoin and they sent it to the BlackRock wallet for their ETF. So like Bitcoin people just tend to do Bitcoin people things and get everybody kind of on board. But it's definitely something worth thinking about. I think today, actually, the Tornado Cash developer, his name's Alexei Pertsev, was found guilty of money laundering in a Dutch court and got 64 months in prison. I find that to be a stretch. Right? It's not as though he laundered money. He just built some software and in an open source way and let people build on it and use it.
Yeah. So I think the best way that I've heard it explained, it's almost like if someone robs a bank, you can't really blame the people that built the highway for the people robbing the bank, right? So it's kind of a mess on everything that's going on, but it is what it is. Hopefully it'll get taken care of in the future. But let's go back to some of the political stuff going on, because there is an interesting super PAC that I think just got started with that was, I think Coinbase is kind of the main one behind it, Stand With Crypto. And what they have done here in like less than a year is raised about $86 million to fund some different candidates. And I think right now they've talked about five of them. Two of them are Democrats and three of them are Republicans. So it's not that they're for one party or the other. It's for the ones that make the most sense to kind of go on the crypto side of things for actual regulation. Well, kind of like what we're talking about, Mark Cuban saying that regulation is needed. And if it doesn't happen, then that's the reason Biden's going to lose.
Yeah, the political side, yeah, it feels like it takes a little bit longer because you really only get a crack at getting your people in or really even have people campaigning on the topics that you care about every 2 or 4 years. And so, you know, if those two or four year cycles don't hit when it's kind of a social issue, like if people aren't really thinking much about crypto in 2022 when it's in the tank and nobody's really paying attention to it. But in 2024, it's going to be a factor. And so, yeah, I think Elizabeth Warren's got a competitor that's actually going to give her a run for her money or at least make her campaign for the first time in a long time. So, yeah, these things, I'm all aboard. Like, make them happen. These politicians need to start understanding that they need to listen to the people in their district. And if 20% of the people in their district have a inclination towards Bitcoin or crypto and they have a tendency to vote, then that matters. So I think it matters. I think it'll be a factor in this election.
Yeah. So I feel like we've talked a lot about the SEC and how much of an idiot they are, but there was some news from the CFTC, which is usually pretty positive, but they have just announced that they want to ban predictive trading in the U.S. And I think out of the five commissioners, three of them agreed on this. So this is somewhat moving forward. And I think it has to go in the comment period for a little while. But what I think it's like 60 days, I think they have to comment. But what it's saying is that these prediction markets are affecting what's happening in these elections. So right now, it was showing Trump had a decent edge. Currently, right now, it's, I think both Trump and Biden are both sitting at 45%. So it's kind of a very even perspective. What's crazy is Michelle Obama has a 5% chance and RFK has a 3% chance. So even less than Michelle Obama is not on
the ballot.
Yeah. I don't know who's voting for Michelle Obama or RFK, but it doesn't sound like your money has a very good chance of winning anything right now.
Yeah. I just, this is my least favorite part of the whole political game is when we get drugged through the mud with the candidates for, honestly, I can't believe I'm not seeing more advertisements and stuff at this point in May ahead of a November election. So yeah, this is why I really like Bitcoin and getting into Bitcoin, is it made me realize that the blue team and the red team, really neither one of them are my team. Like some of the things one side says I like, some of the things the other side says I like, most of what both of them say I don't like. And so, you know, kind of I like that there's a super PAC that's supporting people that are more focused on digital assets. At least those people have an open mind, a dynamic mindset. They realize the status quo can't last forever. And if you just start learning about Bitcoin, the next step is central banks, and the next step is Austrian economics, and like it just helps you reset your brain and get out of the monetary environment that everybody's been born into, you know, since after 1971. And so to me, 45%, that it just tells me that 45% of people don't want to vote against Biden and 45% of people want to vote against Trump. I don't think very many people want to vote for either one of those guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, give me somebody I want to vote for and I'll be excited to vote. But this is not very much fun for me.
It amazes me how we can always choose like the two worst candidates to throw up there every time. So,
like three times in a row now.
Yeah.
At least.
So let's kind of focus a little bit more on Bitcoin and I guess a little bit of everything else too. The crypto markets, if you look at it as a whole, there's a lot of worry that it's going to be under some pressure here pretty soon. And one of that is kind of the altcoins. There's probably about $2 billion worth of unlocks that are going to happen in the next 2.5 months or so. But the other piece of that is Bitcoin, right? The Gemini Earn program has been greenlit to start giving some of that money back. And then you also have all the money from Mt. Gox that is theoretically going to be coming back to those people that had money on there as well. So that's, I mean, the altcoins are 2 billion. That Bitcoin is probably 13 to 15 billion. Right. So, and there's a good chance that probably a third of that is going to be sold almost immediately. So you're going to see some selling pressure from that. But I mean, overall, I think it'll be good to get that out and done with, so we don't have to worry about it anymore at the same time.
Yeah, go ahead and flush it. You know, that Mt. Gox Bitcoin holding has been floated around. It seems like every time the Bitcoin price goes up, people start talking about it again. And then the U.S. government either doesn't sell it or they only sell a small portion and it really doesn't affect anything. So, you know, until that becomes an actual problem, I'm not going to sweat that. We've kind of weathered the storm on all the bankruptcy stuff. The Gemini Earn portion of it seems like a pretty small drop in the bucket. So, you know, you've got announcements every day now of different companies and financial institutions announcing on, what is it, the 13F forms that basically say what they're holding. JP Morgan, UBS, Bank of Montreal, Wells Fargo, Bracebridge Capital, which I think they hold some pensions funds and things like that, have over $400 million in Bitcoin ETFs on the books. So, you know, fine. There's always bad news. The good news is major financial institutions are actually buying into the Bitcoin ETF and getting Bitcoin exposure. Once that happens, dominoes start to fall and everybody looks around like, okay, well, Wells Fargo did it. Even if they did it in a small way, everybody's got to kind of start jumping in. So let it happen. The same kind of thing for that Hong Kong ETF. It had some outflows after the inflows, but there's rumors that they're going to allow mainland China to get exposure to the Bitcoin ETFs through the Hong Kong ETFs, which is what I said about a month ago. It's like this feels like a crack in the door, and then once mainland China billionaires start to want to get it, then you know they can buy yachts for the guys that will allow them to do it. And so you know, there's just too much good news. You can't have all good news. Some sell pressure from a bankruptcy or from Mt. Gox is such a short term. Like you only get to fire that bullet once. Once you sell that Bitcoin, that sell pressure is gone forever, right? And so the other stuff is more just flows. It's like we're digging channels and letting that money flow through that channel for eternity through the ETFs, through different banks getting exposure and all that. So yeah, one-time sell pressure is not that big of a deal compared to long-term fund flow channels that have never been opened before. So that's not a problem for me. Like, go ahead and get it now, and before if this thing ramps up like everybody thinks it will, including me, towards the end of the year, go ahead and let the federal government sell the Mt. Gox stuff now before the price goes up, so that they don't get more value out of the funds that they hold that belong to somebody else. So yeah, sell it cheap.
Yeah, I was looking at the 13F filings, and what was kind of interesting is if you look at all the other ETFs that were created around the same date as the Bitcoin ETFs, the numbers of companies that have announced that they're holding the Bitcoin ETFs on their books since, I guess, what, January is when it came out.
In January, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 250 companies that are holding the BlackRock ETF, which I think the next highest other than the other Bitcoin ETFs is like, there's like six, right? So it is just a huge difference in the amount of traction that they're having in companies. And I mean, like we've said, they're still just at the beginning. I mean, the banks you mentioned, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, and the amount of Bitcoin they're holding is tiny, right? I mean, yep. They're still just like testing it out. Like it's $100,000 worth or a couple hundred thousand dollars worth, if not less than that a lot of times. So there's still a long ways to go. And this is just still the beginning of most of this.
Yeah, I saw that. It might have been a Bloomberg terminal screenshot of the ETFs that all released around the same time. The predominant number was zero, because traditionally financial institutions, there's basically a settling period where they just let the ETF cook and make sure that it survives and all that everything's working, and then there's an evaluation period, and then there's an approval period, and then there's a legal thing, and all these other freaking round and round you go to before people can actually put it on to these financial institutions or corporate balance sheets or whatever. And the Bitwise guys said it, man. It's like, this is going faster than we expected. Like, this is faster than normal. And they put out another tweet this week with a picture of a wealth management annual seminar for a wealth management institution, and standing room only, just guys standing in the back of the room listening. I mean, like, it's going the way it's supposed to go. And in Bitcoin, things can move so fast because you're not in, like, there is no legacy, gigantic bureaucratic organization. And it's just a bunch of individuals that can talk and get together. If there's something to talk about, you can go on Twitter and get on Spaces, and you can basically do a live podcast about it on the spot. And that's just not how these guys roll, you know? And it feels like, holy cow, these ETFs are old. And it's like, no, they're not. If they were any other ETF, institutions wouldn't even be buying them yet. So this all sets up for kind of the same cyclical nature of Bitcoin. And this time there's some pretty big players that are getting into it that weren't before. And like I said, once your competition is looking at it or getting into it, and it's transparent and that you can see it, now you have to take a position on Bitcoin, right? You're either short or long, right? There is no neutral.
Yeah. So one of the other things that I was reading about too was some of the Bitcoin mining things going on. And one, the difficulty dropped like 6%, which is probably one of the biggest drops since back during crypto winter in late 2022. But I think it's also a good thing, allows the miners to kind of get back to profitability with some of the lower end equipment. But Kenya has actually gotten involved with Marathon Digital and been talking quite a bit. So right now, Kenya uses about 80% of their energy is sustainable energy, thermal, geothermal being the big piece, and then wind and solar being the other two pieces of that. But it's just so seasonal for them. So they are trying to get to 100% and not really sure how to do that. And what Marathon Digital has kind of come in and said is Bitcoin mining can actually help you with that. So if you are creating power, you don't want to just let it go nowhere if you have it. And the mining equipment that we've talked about a lot in the past allows these power companies to kind of flip on Bitcoin and turn it on and off and actually get something out of the power that is not in demand at any time, right? So it allows them to control that demand. So there's a lot of talk there. And because of that, Kenya is really looking into kind of setting up their crypto regime. And I think that's kind of what every country has been doing, is how can we put our foot down and create a way that we can survive in the crypto space moving forward, because that is the future, right? So we might actually see some legislation come out of Kenya before we see any come out of the US at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, developing countries have an advantage on this because they don't have this infrastructure and they don't have all these old habits, and they're trying to figure out ways to get power to the citizens that don't have enough power. And yeah, when you do that, and you, especially with wind, you know, typically the wind blows at night and the power usage is down. So if your solution is using wind energy, run Bitcoiners at night, man, and turn them off during the day and let people have, you know, everything else. So for me, I think after a decade in the power industry, Bitcoin mining makes a lot of sense to solve a lot of problems that we have with managing the grid. And whether that grid is ERCOT or if it's some Kenyan small local grid, they all have the same problems. You just need a different number of miners to absorb the excess capacity that and generation that's happening. So great, go for it. I think you could package all that stuff together. And if you're a wind turbine company, package the miners with it and say, hey, look, you know, you don't have to, you, it's not the customer's responsibility to figure out what to do with this excess thing. Here's what we do. You got 50 megawatts of wind, and it comes with 20 megawatts of Bitcoin mining absorption, where if you're not using it, you know, instead of letting the wind turbines freewheel, you just mine Bitcoin and make money. So problem solved.
Yeah, sounds so simple. We'll see what actually happens. El Salvador was in the news here recently too. They've been in the news for quite some time, but they just made their Bitcoin reserves public on a website so you can actually track it. And it's kind of interesting. I think they pledged to buy one Bitcoin every day until it was not possible to buy with fiat money anymore. So you can usually see anytime you look, it's usually plus 7 Bitcoin in the past 7 days. But it's exciting to see that, I mean, I think they're up to over 5,000 Bitcoin at $360 million, and yep, close to 60 of that million is unrealized profit at this point. So what they've done has worked out for them, right? And we'll see if other people follow along very, very soon.
Yeah, no, that's in my notes. Like, you know, I've been thinking about El Salvador and talking to tour guides and looking at hotels and Airbnbs, and yeah, he's at over 5,700 Bitcoin. I think the coolest part about the whole thing is he said he's going to buy one Bitcoin a day, and then 4 years later, he actually bought one Bitcoin a day for all the days in between. And, you know, like, I've been talking to some people that aren't in the Bitcoin circles, you know, they're like, oh, you know, what are your summer plans? I'm like, well, we're going to go to El Salvador, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. El Salvador. And then it kind of launches into a thing about, well, it's on my radar because of Bitcoin, and they've cleaned up the country, and they've got volcanoes you can hike and beaches you can surf and stuff like that. So it's kind of whatever, man. When you do good things, you can turn your reputation around. And when you're honest and you say you're going to buy one Bitcoin every day until you can't anymore, and then you actually do, and then you show everybody that you did, like, you know, Bitcoin is a truth machine. If you didn't buy Bitcoin every day, then somebody could look at it and say, hey, you didn't do what you said. They're like, there, you can't BS Bitcoin. And it's disruptive for the political mo, right? They can't do business as usual, where they just lie every day and don't follow through and don't do anything. Like, if they say it, they got to do it, because the blockchain, they can't change the blockchain.
Yeah, it's probably hard to pinpoint another government in the world that has actually had any transparency in stuff like this, more so than El Salvador. So
yeah, Argentina's on its heels, man. Milei said he's going to fire a bunch of people in the government, and he's doing it. So, you know, it's weird how, like, telling the truth and making sound decisions cleans up some of this nonsense. I feel like everybody knows it, and we've just let it slip for a decade or two. And now it's time for the pendulum to swing the other way. So here we go.
So another thing about Bitcoin that to me is kind of interesting, and maybe because I love the whole NFT concept as well. Runes started about 3 weeks ago on the Bitcoin network, and the first week was just fireworks for that. I mean, it added, I think, $135 million or so of fees to the miners, and they thought that this was the best thing since PB&J, right? That has slowed dramatically, I think, as time has gone on. I mean, it's still adding a few hundred thousand dollars a day of fees, which is great, but I think in the last 12 days or so, it went over a million twice, right? So the activity has definitely slowed down quite a bit. It doesn't have the excitement that it once did. Not to say that won't come back in the future, but it definitely hasn't kind of taken off like a rocket ship, which very few things in crypto actually do.
Other people's things do, not the ones that you buy or I buy.
Yeah, that is true. And then one of the other things that was kind of interesting, so we talked about politics earlier, and not that I pay much attention to it, but Putin just got elected for the fifth term at an 87% acceptance, or whatever you want to call that, approval rate, which is incredibly high considering everything that's going on there. The guy that lost to him has gone out and created a blockchain project that allows you to cast a vote against Putin and keep it somewhat decentralized and anonymous. So they're using the Arbitrum network to do this, and it involves ZK technology, which is stuff that I've talked about in the past that I think will become bigger and bigger, but it is allowing those people to kind of go out and cast a vote. What's kind of cool about it is the company that is kind of helping enable it has said that voting not only would be more secure, but it would probably be 10x cost reduction of what is currently being done. And now today they're only allowing people to have Russian passports to go vote, and it's scanning QR code and allowing you to go place your vote. In the past, anytime you voted against or said anything bad about Putin, the last guy that opposed him, I think, ended up in some Siberian jail and died shortly after that, right? So he does not like to have dissenters in anywhere near him at any time.
Yeah, when Putin won the election, I was like, I bet it's greater than 85% that Bukele got when in El Salvador, because he doesn't like to, you know, Bukele got a lot of good publicity for having 85% of the vote. And so 87 is more than 85. So that's no surprise to me that Putin won with 85.1% or greater percent of the vote. And that falls in line with kind of how I see that happening.
Another thing that kind of hit my radar. So Exodus is a software wallet company that is a pretty, I think they have a great product, but one of the things that they've done is they have tokenized their shares, and they've put that on the Algorand blockchain. They've been trading over the counter for a while, and they officially were somewhat given the green light to move to, is it the NYSE American Exchange, which is kind of like the next level up. And everything was going great until I think they started talking a little bit about how excited they were, and the SEC came in last minute and said, we need to take a look at this. So you're going to stay on the over-the-counter now. I don't think they're a fan of Exodus being the first company to actually tokenize their shares on a public blockchain. Mm-hmm. So to be determined on what happens, but it is definitely another one of those. This is what the SEC does, is they approved it and then all of a sudden last minute decided to change their mind.
Yeah, I mean, you can just feel the digital asset world banging against the SEC. And, you know, the ETF, the Bitcoin ETF was like one notch that got knocked out. And, you know, the Ethereum ETF, nobody's even talking about it really. It was supposed to be the final date's this month. It's not going to happen this time, right? But 6 months, a year from now, like, the SEC has to declare what these things are, what the process is to determine if they're securities or not. They have to do all this stuff. They just refuse to do it. And so I guess it's a delay tactic because, you know, these jobs aren't 20-year positions. So it's like, we'll just delay this until somebody else takes over. They can deal with it. And so that's what it feels like to me. Same thing with, you know, tokenizing your securities or tokenizing your shares. Like, the SEC isn't ready for that. They don't know. They can't even think in those terms. So that'll be the next guy's problem.
Well, I mean, I think one of the big problems in the whole GameStop thing is coming back up. So yeah. They had to halt the trading of those shares yesterday, I think like 6 times.
Yeah.
Right? And I think anybody in crypto just kind of laughs because you don't halt anything in crypto. It's available 24/7 and there's never an issue. Yeah. Yet whatever they're doing, whatever the SEC is kind of in charge of over there, they can't figure out how to make this work for an 8-hour period every single day for 5 days a week. Right. So it would be great if they just said, oh, there's a better solution, let me move it over here. But they had their chance. Exodus was kind of doing part of that, and it's just kind of going backwards at this point.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching what happens with GameStop this time. I feel like a lot of people learned a lot. The investors and the retail guys learned a lot more than the slow-moving institutions and regulators. So, like, I hope they just freaking wreak havoc, like, go nuts. The common person, the voter, hated what went down with the GameStop thing. So shake it up, man. Like, I'm not an agent of chaos. Like, but if it's gonna happen, like, it couldn't happen to a better sector in the economy. It's like, yeah, force those guys to pull the circuit breakers, force them to eliminate the buy button. Like, do all the same stuff, and then tick off everybody, and then let's see who everybody votes for in November over what should be a very important thing, which is you're forced to invest your money. You got to go to work, you got to pay taxes, then you got to pay rent, utilities, groceries, everything, all that other stuff, and whatever's left over, you got to make that money beat the inflation mark. So you put it into index funds or whatever, but most people have a little bit of play money fund where they're like, go after stuff, Nvidia, they go after like smaller stuff. And so most people are doing this, and it's fun, man. The United States has a gambling environment, right? Like, state after state's approving online gambling and sports gambling on your phone. You can bet if the next pitch is a ball or a strike in 22 states. Guess what, man? People dig this GameStop AMC stuff. And tick them off again. Let's see how that works out.
So FTX is in the news again too, right? I mean, other than SBF getting sentenced, there's news now that 98% of the investors in FTX will get 118% of their crypto, of their money back, which is
of their dollar value money back.
Yeah, which sounds great. 118%, you're like, oh, okay, we got more than what we had. But if you look at it, Bitcoin was around 16K back when they went bankrupt, and FTX apparently had less than 0.1% of all the Bitcoin they said they were going to have. So now the value of crypto has gone up 4x, yet they're going to give you 18% of more of your money. So instead of a 500% return, now you're getting 118%, right? So congratulations.
Hey, man. Yeah, like, spend $70, get a hardware wallet, put your stuff on your hardware wallet, and forget about all these stupid problems.
Sounds simple, although that's apparently scary for most people to do. And shoot, it was for me too, I guess, to start. But do small amounts to test it and make sure it works.
Yeah. And educate yourself, man. So I listened to a podcast that a social engineering hacker called a podcaster and he recorded it. He turned into a podcast. The guy was saying that he was from Google, that the customer's information had been compromised. What he was doing was he was trying to get the Coinbase account. And then the podcaster played the game for a little while. And then he was like, "Hey man, you know what you're doing, right? And you know what you're doing is wrong. And your mom's ashamed of you." And then, so this guy, he ended up talking to him for like 20 minutes, spilling his guts. He's a high school kid. He and his buddies scam people out of crypto. They get people to give them either their Coinbase account. They get them to get either that or their seed phrases. And they're talking about scooping tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of crypto. And then all they do, it was exactly what high school kids would do with $100,000, which is buy stupid stuff. And this kid had no idea how hard it is to make money, no idea how hard it is to save money, and the impact of losing it or in getting scammed. And he talked about it like it was no big deal. Him and his buddies do it all the time. You know, it's just part of the gig. And it was the podcast was June Sith's World, which isn't on my radar. It's episode 74. It's worth a listen just to remind you, like, oh, if you get a phone call from Google, Google doesn't call you, right? So if you get a phone call from Google, it's a problem. Ironically, I got a call from Google this week, and I'm like, I'm not playing this game. And then I had a friend of mine that I played trivia with. He shot me a text and he was like, "Hey, can you call me? Or you got time for a call? I think somebody's trying to scam me on my Coinbase account." Guy doesn't have a lot of stuff, but he got a phone call from Google talking about there's an issue, talking about, you know, your password's been compromised. And he was like, "Hey," they started sending me a text message with a link. I was like, "I didn't click the link," an email with the link. I didn't click that. They wanted to change the phone number associated, like all this stuff. And I'm like, don't do any of that stuff. Like, it's good that they put that podcast out there so people will understand it. It's bad because all the jerks that think it's funny to steal people's money but now have kind of an idea of, you know, how to do it. But take your funds off of Coin or Strike or wherever, put it on your hardware wallet. Don't give up that seed phrase. Lock it in. Get your wife to some level of understanding. Get somebody so that if you get hit by a bus, that stuff doesn't just disappear. Safety deposit box. Write a letter with instructions. Like something, some plan so that if you don't make it, your Bitcoin does. But definitely don't give away any information to somebody over the phone. And the kid was talking about, like, almost every day he gets somebody. And sometimes it's $5,000, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's $600,000. So, like, just, yeah, well, here's the thing, man. When Bitcoin goes up, it's going to get crazier. And people are going to, I mean, the honeypot gets bigger for these scammers, man. So just a heads up, man, it's happening. Like I said, in the last week, I got a call. So did a guy I play trivia with. So
I got three of them last week too. So yeah, it is definitely happening more often. But it's one of those things where if I get a call, I'm also going to check my email to see if I have any sort of notification. And
yep,
it's funny. Like, I got three different calls. Two of them actually had the same amount of Bitcoin that they said there was an issue, and the other one was Ethereum, different amount, right? And I'm just like, okay, if you ever do get a call, don't do the call, go to your Coinbase account that you should have bookmarked. Don't Google Coinbase or whatever it is, right? And go into that link and go directly in there and check it from there. And then you can call them from the website on what they provide there, not ever have them call you. It just doesn't make sense.
Yep. And they can send you an email that looks like it's from Google, and they can create a website that looks just like Coinbase. And once you type in that password, you're done.
Yeah. Well, two-factor authentication is also very important. If you don't have that enabled on at least Coinbase, then do that as well.
Agreed.
All right. So a few other things that I had that were kind of more fun. The Sandbox has been a project I've been paying attention to for quite a while at this point, but it's the whole metaverse concept. And what was interesting with the Sandbox is they've pretty much come out and said they have about 6 million accounts. So, I mean, they're still pretty small, all things considered. But what they've enabled is a game creator so that people can go in and actually create games in the metaverse for you to go play. And they've had, I think it's just under 300,000 people have gone and created games. And what they're calling is 2024 is kind of the year of the creator. And, I mean, we're still probably 3 to 5 years away before you start seeing the metaverse really take off. But it's exciting to see this happening. And I think one of the games that was created was The Voice, and you can kind of go through and try to win The Voice type thing, right? So there's a bunch of little things that are going on there, and they're giving some incentives to people that are going in and creating games. But I mean, the cool part is that you don't have to understand how to create a game now, because they've created a way to make it easy for you. So exciting to see that progress is being made, at least in the metaverse space.
Yeah, I mean, it's about time to start hearing about the metaverse again.
Well, Meta has actually made a pretty big bet on that, right? So, I mean, the expectation is at some point that will actually pay off for them.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm not the kind of Bitcoiner that's against everything. Like, try stuff, see what happens.
Yeah, and then the one other thing that was kind of fun, I know we've talked about NFTs in the past, but there's one out there called Pudgy Penguins, which is probably one of the top 10 NFT projects out there. They have just passed or surpassed over 1 million units of their stuffies that have been sold in Walmarts and other places as well. I think Amazon has it. They just signed Target officially. Walmart, I think, is about to place another reorder to put more of them on there. But, I mean, this is kind of a serious NFT, because their floor price, it was at just over 11 ETH, and now it's just over 12 ETH. So you're talking about $36,000 for one of these NFTs, and now they're selling more than a million units, and they've done this in less than a year too. So it's kind of interesting to see how this NFT space has evolved into actual real world product as well.
I mean, nothing sounds more like Beanie Babies than Pudgy Penguins.
I'm a fan. Penguins are one of my favorite animals, so I would love to see them be successful. I'm still not sure what the point of having one is, but I think each one comes with its own QR code that gives you special characteristics that are listed on the blockchain. So kind of fun, I guess.
Not worth 12 ETH.
Oh, well, that's the NFT on the blockchain. That's, you're not paying for that in the school, at the Walmarts and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Go for it, Pudgy Penguins.
Yeah. So that's all I had on my end. Anything else that I missed?
No, I think that's good. I think the one thing I wanted to talk about was that social engineering hack where people are making phone calls to people that likely have Coinbase accounts. So that's something that was new. And, you know, I like to talk about stuff that I've actually, that's hit my radar in the real world. And like, you got phone calls, I got phone calls, my buddy from Trivia got phone calls, people are going to get phone calls.
Yeah. So I'll try to add the link to that podcast in the show notes to make it easy for people to go listen. Awesome. Well, Hal, as always, great to talk with you. We'll talk again next week and see what's changed at that point.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.